Good morning. I know it's a little bit early. I know it's the last day of the conference, but sometimes we do save the best for last here. Welcome to our sound on film session. When a lot of us think of sound recordings, we typically think of tape, vinyl, shellac, wax, smoked paper. but not always do we think about sound on film. That is, unless you're one of our first two panelists this morning. Chris Hunter is the curator at the Schenectady Museum. Since 1998, he's overseen the collection of GE memorabilia that includes 1.6 million photographs, 1,000 motion picture films, 25,000 technology artifacts, and early sound recordings made from radio station WGY. This morning, he'll introduce to us the sound recording and broadcasting collections at the museum, which include the intriguing Palafotophone sound films from the 1920s. Chris?
Thank you. Since probably nobody in the room save one person has been to the Schenectady Museum before, I thought I would start out just kind of doing a quick highlight of some of the collections. Peter Dilge, the Edison collector, called this the oldest album cover of all time. It's a sleeve from an Edison tinfoil recording that was made in St. Louis on June 22, 1878. And it came with an original tinfoil that was donated to the museum in 1978 for GE's 100th anniversary. So we actually just got a grant from Save America's Treasures, which is being administered by NEH, to do some conservation work on this and digitize it. The 25,000 artifacts we have, probably about 200, I'd consider kind of radio and phonographs. So kind of clockwise from the upper left, we have their standard Edison phonograph setup. The upper right is a GE Playtalk, which is a magnetic disc recording system from 1948. The lower right is a gramophone, and lower left is GE's first tube radio from 1913, which we also have in kind of probably one of the biggest artifacts in our collection is a 2 kilowatt. Alexanderson alternator from 1911, which people have been looking at it lately and think they could probably get it up into working condition so the one in Grimeton, Sweden can have something to talk to. We also have a lot of advertising and probably about 300 radio scripts. This is a first page from The Sound Man's Nightmare, which was done during the W2XOY FM station first anniversary, I think, in 1941. These were scripts that were donated by Dorothy Sweeney, who was one of the sound effects people working at WGY during World War II. This is Colin Hager, the first announcer and later program manager for WGY, with a series of microphones in the 1930s, and this is a recreation of Hager's first announcement on WGY in 1922, which was done for the 1952 anniversary program, for which we have the master reels. Whoops, and I just jumped out here.
Colin Hager speaking. This is radio station WGY in Schenectady. W for wireless, G for General Electric, and Y for the last letter in our city.
Okay, we have about 5,000 photographs from WGY. This is a stage sound effects scene for a program called Danger from the mid-1920s. And then the photographs go up into the late 40s and early 50s. This is Duke Ellington with Howard Rieg, the former NBC News announcer, on his left-hand side. This was the WGY 26th anniversary program. And then these next two photographs are some of the favorites in the collection. This would be the DJ's nightmare. This is a WGY DJ named Vern Cook in the early 50s, and then then the record collector's nightmare. Okay, so I started in the museum in 1998, and one of the longtime volunteers at the time showed me these kind of strange looking films with nothing but soundtracks on them, and film didn't have any sprockets, and there were these faded and totally decayed press releases in a couple of them, a little bit of writing on the cans, but nobody was essentially able to play these. There were 12 of these films. We actually picked up a 13th film in 2007 from Colin Hager's daughter, who found it in a closet in a metal box and had no idea what it was. So in 2009, a GE materials engineer named Russ DeMuth actually built a machine to was able to play these films back so we could actually see what was on them. And some of the press release and the writings were on the cans were right, some weren't, but it's a variable area soundtrack, 2mm soundtracks. For the film speed, we've been seeing conflicting information. In one place, we see 22.5 centimeters, which equates to approximately 44.3 feet per minute. Other places, 45 feet per minute. So a little bit of variation, but a little bit of variation is all you need to totally throw things off. We do actually have some calibration opportunities with some of the voice recordings of Calvin Coolidge and Edison and Damrosch and the NBC chimes. Okay, so that's the machine that we built to play them back. And that's another image of the machine. We're actually, now that we've kind of done the pilot project, we're going to be looking for, nobody involved in the project up to this point has really been an audio engineer, so we really need the audio engineer perspective to really get this done right and get the films done as good as possible. At this point, I think we call them experimental recordings of experimental recordings. So you have the problems with that they would have had with the original film phonograph machine, any problems we had with this machine, and then any problems that kind of cropped up in the films over the 80 years that they were in storage. So the story of the Pella photophone, or shaking light sound, starts at the end of World War I with a effort to create a high-speed telegraph recorder that could record up to 600 words per minute. The tubes are actually house the developer and the fixer, so it would process itself as it's going through the system. So the top image here is a wireless message from a radio station in Germany during the war. And then after the war, they were looking what to do next with this, and they thought, okay, hey, if we can do telegraph, we can probably do voice. So in 1922, GE announces that it's perfected voice recording, and this is Calvin Coolidge with the Pella photophone machine down in Washington, D.C. They did a series of recordings December 14th, 1922, and then played them back over WGY on Christmas Eve. This is a brief introduction. This is a brief introduction from the host of the program, Howard Tupper in 52, and also the person who saved the recording. Okay, let's see if General Pershing works better. Oops.
On the same broadcast, Christmas greetings were broadcast by another great American, the late General John J. Pershing, hero of the First World War. Here he is now, from the original Palafotophone recording.
As a nation, we can serve civilization in no finer way than by giving the world the living example of a free government of law and order, founded upon the great principles that were the inspiration of our forefathers.
Okay, so Hoaxy here is holding a piece of the original Palafotophone film, showing it to Cipriano Alvarado, a Quiche Indian, who's one of the last speakers of the Mayan language, who was at the Smithsonian Institution at the time. The Smithsonian curators heard that Hoaxy was in town and set him up for an all-night recording session. Yes?
So your source for what you just played was a later playback with commentary.
Yes.
And what period did that playback take from?
That playback dated from 1952.
Okay. And what was it played on?
So I think in the early 30s they transferred it to an electrical transcription before the original equipment all disappeared. The original recording, about a dozen of the original recordings are supposed to be in the Library of Congress through a kind of a long roundabout way via Syracuse University and the American Film Institute, and the library is searching for them now. They've located two of them so far. Actually, the one of Cipriano Alvarado and then a sportscaster talking about Babe Ruth. So they did a whole series of recordings of kind of famous Americans, David Sarnoff, Jackie Coogan, who's pictured here, Charles Dana Gibson, and others through September 1923. And then the project kind of went quiet for a few years. They did work adapting part of the system with Brunswick for the Palatrope electrical recording system. And then in 1926, they announced that they had developed a talking motion picture system. So this is one of the pictures from the collection from July 1926 with a confidential note from the GE Patent Department in August 1926. Of course, you can have the greatest motion picture film system in the world, but if you don't have an amplifier and a loudspeaker in the theaters, it's pretty much useless. So this is from left to right, Edward Kellogg, Chester Rice, and Clarence Hewlett with GE's loudspeaker system. In January 1927, mind you, this is August 1926, the Vitaphone system premiered with the Don Juan with music to a synchronized disc. On January 27, GE held a demonstration at the State Theater in Schenectady, where they had a variety of speakers, musicians, and two reels of the movie Flesh and the Devil, John Gilbert and I believe Greta Garbo. And there were mostly synchronized music. They still weren't sure about talking pictures yet. And they included two pieces of soundtrack, which was a pistol shot and a whack of a newspaper. April 1928, RCA Photophone is formed out of this Conegraphone research. Now, the Vitaphone disc is formed in August 26. The Movie Tone system, which coincidentally was also formed in upstate New York at the Case Labs in Auburn, which is kind of an interesting side note that both of those systems were developed about 150 miles apart in upstate New York. Movie Tone and premiered in January 1927. And this is the Gramercy Studios for RCA in 1930. The Photophone system, they kind of took their time getting it out there. They installed the first full system at Rochester's Eastman Theater in October 1928. Then with the acquisition of the RKO theaters, they pretty quickly had a whole series of theaters set by late December, early January 1929. Okay, so the next effort was researcher Clarence Hewlett. He was a classical music buff, played the violin and kind of bemoaned the lack of quality long form recording systems. So what he did was he took the picture back off of the film and decided, okay, if we can have one soundtrack with the picture, we can have about a dozen soundtracks if we don't have the picture. So he developed this continuous looping system called the film phonograph. First system they used was kind of a basic system. You would run it to the end and then reverse everything and then run it back to the beginning. You lost time reversing the motors and everything, so that wasn't good enough. So they developed a continuous looping system. And essentially you can see it just to the southeast of the armature. There's a little piece of metal, and that metal would trip an electromagnet on a ratchet, and it would ratchet the soundtrack over 2.5 millimeters, so it would record the next track without losing just one little tiny piece of the sound, but that still wasn't good enough. And they also called the film phonograph the book film recorder. They had the idea that they were going to do talking books. But this is a good soundtrack gone bad. The third system, which has really proven to be a challenge with us, it moved the soundtrack gradually over the entire course of the film. So over a course of a 400-foot film, it moved the soundtrack 2.5 millimeters, or about a 2/1000th of a percent gradient. So for a while, we weren't sure what was going to be, because we would start out playing one track, and then it would jump to another track. And then I was finally able to get access to some of Hewlett's papers at Union College, and there was a binder on his film phonograph project, and one of his speeches had mentioned they had developed this new gradual system. So then we started going back and looking at, I think, the last five films, and we've actually found some hidden tracks that actually started in the middle of the film. Okay, so for the recordings, then we have 13 rolls of film. Actually, look at some of there's a mixture of kind of local and network programs. There's a Midsummer Night's Dream at WGY Players Drama from April 24th, 1929. Some WGY concert orchestra programs, a program pop music program called the Kane Crooners, based on that was sponsored by Albany and Troy, New York jewelry store. And this should be the NBC Chimes, An Introduction to the Lucky Strike Hour from early 1930. Whoops.
You are listening to WGY in Schenectady.
Good evening, my friends. And so begins this hour of dance music, presented for your pleasure by the manufacturers of Lucky Strike cigarettes. B.A. Rolfe and his Lucky Strike Dance Orchestra will be heard in the tunes that made Broadway, Broadway. Should you sit out a dance, may I suggest, reach for a Lucky instead of a Sweet. The Lucky Strike Dance Orchestra opens with Everybody Step, and I Kiss Your Hand, Madame.
So, Walter Damrosch hosted the GE Radio Hour in, I think, from 1929 up until around 1932. It was Saturdays at 9 p.m. on NBC. So, kind of in the same vein as the Music Appreciation Hour, he would do kind of a lengthy introduction to each number.
Our first number. Yeah.
These are some excerpts to Rossini's William
Tell
overture.
The most popular overture that has ever been written. The overture to William Tell by Rossini. Story of the liberation of Switzerland from the Austrian yoke.
That was from the April 20th, 1929 program, and this is an advertisement for the April 27th, 1929 program, and each program was sponsored by a GE product. In this case, the program was devoted to the electric servants in the home, or motors. Oops.
You have heard, ladies and gentlemen, the General Electric Hour presented to acquaint you with domestic appliances and the motors which operate them. These programs are broadcast for the purpose of making you familiar with the many electric products which General Electric and its associated companies manufacture and which are sold throughout the world. If you are interested in an electric washing machine, an ironer, or a dishwasher, a health machine, or any other electric device for your home, write to the General Electric Company, either at Schenectady, New York, or in care of the station to which you are listening for descriptive material. General Electric offers this service gladly and without obligation. When buying electric equipment, look for the General Electric monogram, GE in a circle. It is a symbol of research and a mark of electrical quality and dependability, the initials of a friend. The General Electric hour now closes. During the last few seconds, the chimes of Telecron, the modern electric timekeeper that operates from your lighting circuit, have been heralding the hour. It is now exactly 45 seconds past 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. This is Edmund Ruffner announcing. There is now a brief pause for station announcement.
You are listening to the General Electric station in Schenectady, WGY.
And this is an audio photophone film that Damrosch did in March 1929 for GE.
Ladies and gentlemen, I have just had one of the most exciting mornings of my life. I've just spent half an hour in the general laboratories of the General Electric Company, and they gave me a complete reproduction of a concert which I conducted in New York last Saturday evening at the broadcasting room of the National Broadcasting Company, together with all my explanatory comments on the music. And for the first time in my life, I have heard my orchestra playing first an overture of Don Giovanni's by Mozart, then the Redemption by César Franz, and ending with the Second Rhapsody of Liszt. And all I can tell you is that I was delighted with the playing of my orchestra. I will say nothing about the excellence of the conductor. One hears all kinds of marvels now about the interchange of sound and light, that they are the same thing, but variations, which are vibrations, which express themselves in different fashions. And I would myself like to take advantage of this opportunity and also, for the first time in my life, see sound. So I would like to play the chord of C on the piano and then see it photographed on the film. Let us take the chord of
Ray. So, some of the earliest movie special effects. Okay, so this is a picture of Damrosch in the orchestra, kind of an all-star orchestra made out of the variety of different New York City orchestras. And probably the most significant recording in the collection is the basketball game. It's the third quarter of the Eastern States Basketball Championships. Halftime scores 21-19. Schenectady is leading St. Mary's of Westfield, Massachusetts. The announcer is Graham McNamee. According to a Time magazine article done years later, McNamee claimed that he had to broadcast a basketball game to the last minute once and learn the game while going up to Glens Falls on the train. I'm guessing this is the game, and this is the Schenectady High School basketball team. So this is a kind of a slightly longer clip, about 3 minutes long, and remember the name McManus and how many people are on a basketball team.
We were just kind of stopped in our work for a moment by an untimely situation. But it's all right now, and the game is on. There, the ball is in the air. The boys have touched it. Palowicz now has the ball. DeFeo now has it. DeFeo shoots, but misses. Someone else of the Schenectady team almost drove it into the basket of St. Mary, but not quite. The score, you know, at the opening of the second half is 21-19 in favor of Schenectady. O'Rourke dribbles the ball down, and now Funston has the ball. Going back into St. Mary's territory, he almost shoots, but passes to DeFeo. He passes to Nublo. DeNublo shoots, but misses his basket. The ball goes out of bounds. Funston takes it out of the bounds for Schenectady, passes it down to DeFeo in the middle of the field. DeFeo to Funston, and Funston dribbles up for off the line and shoots his basket. That was Funston making the score 23-19 in favor of Schenectady. Takes it out of bounds, and now he passes back to Funston. Funston has the ball, is looking around as to where to shoot it, but finally gives it to DeFeo. And now McManus has it. McManus is looking the situation over and starts to dribble up towards St. Mary's goal himself. Passes back to DeFeo. DeFeo passes to O'Rourke of St. Mary's. I think O'Rourke was fouled by Funston, yes. So the referee, he gets one free shot at the basket. O'Rourke shoots and shoots, makes his foul, leaving the score
oldest surviving recording of
23 to 20 in favor of Schenectady. Disco shoots for the basket, just fails to make it from the middle of the floor. Funston now has it, passes to McManus of Schenectady. They're just in the middle of the floor, and just as the whistle blows, the ball is knocked from his hand. It's not a foul, however. Disco now has the ball, and he passes to Gruber. Gruber passes to Devine. Devine dribbles it a bit near and shoots a basket, making the score 23-22 in favor of Schenectady. McManus now has the ball for Schenectady, passes to McManus, and McManus tosses the basket. Oh no, no score. The whistle had blown just before. Bowlitz takes the ball out of bounds, and then as it's put into play again, Gruber passes it back to Devine. Devine passes it back to Sisko, and Sisko tries a long basket from the middle of the floor. O'Rourke now has the ball. He failed on that basket. O'Rourke has the ball. The score is 23-22 in favor of Schenectady. Gruber shoots, but failed, and McManus dribbled all the way up the line, passes to DeFeo, back to DeNublo. DeNublo tries for the basket and just fails to come. Somebody's down on his ear. It's Devine. Gruber has the ball.
Yeah, that classic sports statement, somebody's down on his ear. So this is the WGY Orchestra, which did a couple local programs. And basically with the split of RCA and GE in 1930, the Photophone and all the sound recording research went down to Camden, New Jersey. So some people, including Edward Kellogg, went with RCA. Clarence Hewlett stayed at GE and moved into early photovoltaic research. It's a picture from 1934 of a solar-powered motor. So that concludes my presentation, and I think we've got time for a question or two. Yes. Of the Rolf broadcast, there's about essentially what Hewlett was doing would be he would keep the machine running after the GE hour was over. So sometimes depending on the night, it would be 10 minutes. It would be almost a complete broadcast in a couple occasions, but there's parts of eight of those, I think.
Okay. Yeah, the one with the Kane, the film with the Kane program, that has a complete B.A. Rolf show, because the Kane show came on after the B.A. Rolf show. So it's good stuff on there.
Yeah, so I think a future session, maybe at ARSC next year in Rochester, might be appropriate since Rolf was a native of Utica, New York. So.
Oh, really?
Yes.
So were these done for archival purposes? They weren't meant for rebroadcast or anything.
No, they were laboratory research trying to perfect a new product called the film phonograph.
It was all experimental.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The 1922s were for broadcast. Yeah. The ones that were made of the voices in Washington, those were broadcast. Those were meant for broadcast. But these were not.
Are there any others that exist in other archives or locations?
Yeah, of the 1929 multi-tracks, I haven't seen any, but I'd never say never. For the 1922, the Library of Congress, I've seen documentation that they have a dozen of them. They talking with some of their preservation techs. They think some of the kind of transfer with the AFI collection was slightly spotty, and there's like entire rooms of kind of orphan films. So they've located two of them so far. It's got the one inch soundtrack, and of the others that they have, it includes Hoxie and GE lab director Willis Whitney talking about the use of the Palafoto phone, and there was a recording that we've got documentation that it was done off of WGY of Alfred E. Smith, inauguration speech as New York governor in January 1st, 1923, which if that's true, that would probably be the oldest surviving recording of a radio broadcast.
Well, with announcing.
Yeah.
Great, thank you, Chris.